It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hey all, this is the second half of our discussion and interview with Steena Light. This is, again, the proper interview, the actual point where we ask her questions specific to the book. So thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy the interview and that you enjoyed our discussion with Steena Light about urban fantasy. Alrighty. So since you have been on this show before, I don't want to do the whole, like, what got you into writing stuff, because we've already asked you that. So I just thought we would dive in, and why don't you tell us about and Blue Skies from Pain.
Well, in the second book, I feel like Liam grows up a bit, and it's about him standing up and going along with the church's investigation as to whether or not there's a distinction between fallen angels and fairies, because as it stands, the church only believes in fallen angels and demons. They don't acknowledge any other form of preternatural creature. They just don't. So he has to be examined by inquisitors, and he has to go through that whole process. And of course, it's very scary, because really, whenever you have to sit down and let inquisitors examine you medically, that's going to be a little scary, I have to say. Anyone who walks around with the title inquisitor.
Fair enough, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't exactly have a positive
connotation. No, for good reason.
But of course, Liam has a history in why this kind of is not good.
Yeah.
An extra history, yes.
Yeah.
Extra Which added.
You need to read the first book to know about.
Yeah, but then at the same time, I'm kind of proud of the fact that several people have read it without reading the first book and have done just fine. Because I feel like, I've always admired the way Terry Pratchett handles the series. Everything builds on everything else, but at the same time, each stands alone. And that has long been a goal of mine. So, yeah, yay to know that I even halfway did it. It makes me happy. But that's largely what the book is about. And of course, there's some car chases and bank robbery, and because I kind of have to have that in there, because it's
all fun. The fun stuff.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And of course, it's set during, well, I guess you would say, one of the many troubles for the Irish and their conflicts with the English.
Yeah, it's the Troubles is actually a term used for a 30-year war, or 40-year war, 30-year war, 30-year war. So, and it's 1977, so it's smack in the middle of all that.
Yeah, and it's I'm taking a James Joyce class right now, so.
Oh, good.
When
good
I actually
you.
Brought up,
I couldn't
you know,
get through. I tried. I really did.
Really hard. I did bring that up though in class. I mentioned that I was reading a book that was an urban fantasy, but it was set during the Troubles in Ireland, and the teacher was like, it's like, which Troubles? And I was like, I don't know what you mean. He's like, well, there's a lot of trouble.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of 500 years. Yeah.
So it was fun. And it is very interesting too that I got to read this book while I'm reading what is essentially, I'm reading Ulysses, which is essentially a book that's set right at what becomes the independence movement, the nationalist independence movement in Ireland, and there would actually be a treaty in 1921 number of violent attacks from both sides, well, obviously.
Yeah, and the Special Powers Act was established in 1921, which has a heavy influence on what is going on in 1977.
So, I'm not an expert in Irish history, as some people on this in this episode, though. So,
I wouldn't consider myself an expert, frankly. That's up to the people that actually live there, if you ask me.
Yeah, and that actually brings me to my question, because I remember in our last interview with you for the previous book, which was fantastic, you'd mentioned that you were really worried about how Irish readers would receive your book, and particularly the people that you'd spoken to for help on the sort of historical aspects and making sure you got even little details right to make sure that, you know, you did, you could talk about the Irish experience, as it were. And did you still feel that you were like that sort of worry, that fear, or was that dissipated a bit? Did you feel more comfortable in writing this book?
Initially, no, I didn't, because I did take 3 years researching the entire thing as much as I could. And this time around, I had less than a year to write another book. And the first thing I did was freak out, because I didn't think I would have enough time to amass enough information. But then after speaking to Nicholas White, who is an expert on Northern Irish politics, I began to realize that I really could have the confidence to speak about things. And if I messed it up, he would definitely catch me. So that actually helped tremendously after I had my little crying fit on my after I soaked the front of my agent's shirt for the summer, because I was so scared.
But well, and this one seems to, I mean, it rests less heavily on those political dynamics,
yes,
than the first one does. So
yes. And I did that on purpose, because, again, the original intent was, I mean, I am a fantasy writer, and as much as I love historical fiction, I never really intended to be a historical fiction writer. And I never really intended for that story to stay in the politics 100%, like it does in the beginning. Well, it's, I'd say 98%, as it does in the first book.
Right.
I never intended it to stay there, because Stephen King is one of my favorite writers. And one of the reasons why is because I just love the way he sets up everything, where it's so real. Everything is so real. And then one day you're with the character, with the, eating their cornflakes that morning, and you know it's Kellogg's cornflakes, because, you know, it's just so real. And they're sitting at the table, and then they get up and they walk down a hallway, and then all of a sudden, boof, werewolf! And it's totally real. And I always thought that was fantastic, because it added to the horror of what was going on, and it added to the experience of reading the book. Because to me, reading a book is like buying a ticket on a Disney ride. You know, you want to experience someone else's life and be in a different place. And to make that as realistic and fun and up close as personal, personal as possible, for the reader, I think is the writer's job. So I feel that anything that gets in the way of that is not really a good thing. So, yeah, that's why I wanted to make it as real as I could at the beginning, and then kind of veer away from that bit by bit. And that's why the second book is much further out of that. And I wanted to do in like the third book is going to be even further. That's where we're going to explore a lot more of the Fianna and what's going on with the wars on that side of things. Anyway, that's my evil plan.
So I think one of the interesting themes in your book is actually related to kind of the progression of the two books so far. The first book having sort of Liam dealing with the sort of national movement and being trapped in kind of all these various relations to his country, which is being essentially occupied. And then in this book, where he's now being brought into this conflict with the church. And I'm guessing then, of course, the third book will bring us even more conflicts. But I think the interesting thing is this: Liam's sort of growing frustration with feeling like a pawn, and he sometimes says it almost explicitly. You know, that he's kind of gets really fed up with everybody kind of trying to use him because he has various things that are useful for the church. You know, it's useful because he's half fae. For the IRA, it's because, well, he's got a history and he's apparently really good at driving. He's a fantastic driver because he's half fae. But right. And these various things, you know, he's being used by essentially everybody is using him to some extent for something. And I think it's interesting too is when he joins up with the IRA, someone essentially says as a reason for why he should join with them again. Is, quote, Ireland needs you, son. And that's like the only reason the guy gives is essentially that. And I guess what I kind of wanted to get at was, do you see Liam as a character, as a kind of maybe an allegorical figure for the like nation of Ireland in this moment, as someone who's maybe that someone who's just kind of had it with all the forms of nationalism and ideology that's around him, because they're all kind of dogmatic and pushing for this like pure, like we want this and this is the only thing we want, and the other side says, well, we only want this, and he's sort of gets trapped in it. He doesn't want any of that.
Well, here's the thing. I'm not Irish, so I can't really claim a commentary along those lines. I have to speak from my own experiences, and the experiences I'm drawing from regarding nationalism have a lot more to do with what is happening in the United States right now. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm actually pulling things from. I find that they both have a lot of overlap just from my experience. But since I haven't experienced that in Ireland, I wouldn't know that 100%. So while you're perfectly welcome to draw those kinds of parallels, go right ahead. I'm not going to argue against them, but I'm not going to stand there and categorically say that that's what my intention was necessarily. I feel that one of the things that is common to nationalism in general, no matter what country, it's a kind of a dangerous thing either way. You know what I mean? Yeah. If it's anything given to us to an extreme is a bad thing. That's pretty much how I look at it. Things should be, I prefer balances and I prefer checks and balances.
So much for those.
Yeah. So much for that right now. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, the magical capitalism fairy will take care of everything. And you know, everyone will magically do what they're supposed to do, even though we're living in chaos. Excuse me. Yeah. Sorry.
I've never been that. But only because the people who say, well, the government can't do the job, but capitalism can, is like, you do realize that you think the government can't do its job because people suck, but capitalism is run by people.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And that's government's job, actually. To be government.
Yeah.
That is not business's job. Business's job is to make a profit. But I'm going to step down off my soapbox.
Off the political soapbox, yeah.
You're going to complain about the $900 toilet seat. Who sold them the toilet seat to begin with? Excuse me? Anyway.
I don't see there's anything necessarily wrong with making the distinction. I mean, it's a distinction I think most people would agree with. It's like, yes, a business's job is to make money. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. It's only when that drive to make profit becomes abusive, and there is a line at which, you know, you just can't cross that. But, like, you know, everybody wants businesses to do well.
Yes, exactly. It's not that I hate business or anything like that. That's not the point. It's that there is a balance, and everything requires checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And for people to say that businesses do not need regulation is, it just floors me, because I keep thinking you have fundamentally checked out on one of humanity's main qualities. You know, you're just not paying attention. Have you ever seen a teenager without any kind of rules?
It always cracks me up, because people will sit there and say, well, communism doesn't work because people are selfish. You're like, but somehow capitalism will work perfectly if
because people are selfish.
Anyway, my belief, there is no one system that is 100% the answer for everything. Because if there was one, we would have figured it out by now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm of the same opinion. You know, I Jen and I would probably be called like socialist, communist, fascists or something, even though we're neither of those things.
In fact, my uncle spent, when I went up to Dallas this January, spent a lot of time calling me a socialist.
Like, I love when people call me that. You're like, yeah.
I just like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Of course, when they say socialist, they mean like you don't believe in votes and democracy. It's like, no, you can still be a socialist and believe that we have a right to vote. Yeah. It's not. You're
but
thinking
I'm still
something
not a socialist,
else.
Even if they, that is what they're thinking. Even if they're thinking the correct method of socialist, I'm not a socialist. I'm not. I'm just not.
No,
that's okay. They can call me. I've proudly taken up the mantle of Pinko Call Me many times.
Yep, over the years,
but I was also raised by a man who was raised by parents who lived on a commune and were part of a literally utopian socialist society. So I get to take up that mantle and be like, booyah, yes I am, thank you.
Go you.
Yeah, I wish I had that experience.
It's a political liability, but I'm like, no, whatever. If I've got a problem with that, then so be it.
You had a different experience. It doesn't mean you want the whole country to go live like a commune.
I don't. In fact, I would prefer that they didn't.
See?
I don't live on a commune for a reason.
Yeah. There you are.
And this now makes sense, sort of, why Liam is conflicted by all these things, and why you would say, of course, that you're drawing from your own experiences and kind of transplanting them into a separate national setting, and that these still kind of bleed over. And it's precisely that issue that, well, Liam is that kind of character who does not feel comfortable with any of these particular ideologies.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't claim socialism. I mean, his wife did, but he doesn't.
I like that conflict a lot. I enjoy that. Because that's my conflict in some... Well, I'm not quite... I should couch that very carefully. I have not lived Liam's experience, so I have not had certain people in my life die. I have not been imprisoned in a violent prison and been abused, et cetera, et cetera. But I have those, you know, I'm not a crazy in on any particular ideology. And I don't think that anybody should. I think you have to be critical of the ideologies around you.
So. Yeah, I think so too. I definitely do.
Even the ones you agree with, you have to be critical of them.
Yes, exactly. I think it's important because otherwise, again, you'll start going into fanaticism, and that's
which
when
is
things
closely
get
closely related to nationalism, sadly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, nationalism—it's very easy for that to slip into a kind of fanaticism. And in fact, most Americans are, whether they want to admit it or not, are fanatics when it comes to their nationalism. You know, the idea that, you know, you're threatening America, you're threatening us all, and, you know, that we are, as soon as, you know, that call comes out, like after 9/11, I think is a
great
example.
Oh my God, that was nuts! Wasn't it nuts? I was horrified. And to see how, like, all of the bumper stickers were like, proud to be American, I was so sorely tempted to make up a bumper sticker that said, isn't pride one of the 7 deadly sins? But I knew that if I did that, my car would be blown up or something.
But it's just the complete uncritical just adherence. Like, I love America. I hate it too, but I love it.
But I think that's how... But that's what makes America special is we're allowed to love and hate it
and
at the same
time.
And
hate our country, yeah.
Yes.
Well, not according to some people. I'm an American. I should go live in some...
Stop with the accent. Now you're just being insulting.
I am just being insulting. Sorry, but I've heard too many people who talk with that accent.
That's because you live in the South. I'm sorry.
I live in Florida, which is not... It's the South, but nobody has the accent here.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
yeah, that's true. I mean, it's the South, but yet it's not... It's
so
not the
I
old
had
South.
This...
Yeah.
I had this really brilliant question...
Mm-hmm.
And it was all well thought out and 2 paragraphs long. And then I just realized that you answered it.
Oh.
So you suck. I'm just kidding. No,
well, you can ask it anyway and then tell me that, you know.
I'll tell you the gist of it. Because it went back to the fact that I said, you know, the politics really don't play a big role in this one. The first book was really very much about the human implications of the Troubles and how Liam's life was complicated by those things. The Fae parts kind of just added another level to the complication. Yeah. But as my question said, it was more of a deus ex machina than a key factor to what
deus,
was already
deus.
Deus, whatever, because I care. Anyway, it wasn't, he was going to be forced to choose a side regardless of who or what he was.
Yes.
In that sense, that it wasn't, yes, there were characters that were obviously Fae or Fallen that were screwing with him, but he was probably going to be screwed with regardless because of the time that he lived in.
Yes.
But Blue Skies from Pain, that's why I said it's very different. You don't have that. It's less about those politics, the human politics, and you have more on the politics of the Fae versus the Fallen, and the Fallen versus the Church, and the Fae versus the Church, and you've added even more of the and the Church versus the Church. Yeah, you've added even more of the urban fantasy elements. This is why I say you totally freaking answered the question, because now we have ghosts.
Yes,
we've got more Fallen than were ever in the first book. I'm trying to remember how many Fallen were even in the first book.
Not that many.
There were maybe
six
like
or seven, maybe.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the main bad guy is actually Fae. Love Red Caps, by the way.
Yeah, aren't they great?
Then, I go around and I go, that person's a Red Cap. That person's a Red Cap. That person's a Red Cap. Because they're so easily recognizable in my book, especially if you've played Changeling.
Yeah, true.
So,
I have to say, I was really proud when there was a British reviewer who was like, oh my God, matching up Red Caps with the paratroopers, genius! And I was like, yoo-hoo!
Absolutely brilliant.
Because I saw that picture of the paratrooper with the red cap. I was just like, oh my God, wow!
I'm using that!
Yeah, no, it was so in there!
It was really done, but okay, and then you also have the Fae Clan Wars, which was, yes, it was in the first book as well, but you didn't see kind of the backgrounds. You didn't really know how much of a clan war thing was going on. So that's all much more prevalent in this book. And Liam, to an extent, is still being swept along without a great deal of extent. Consent.
Yes.
However, in this one, he definitely kind of goes, I'm going to take a stand. I'm going to, I can do this. I am a man. I'm going to take ownership of my own destiny, which was really nice to see from Liam, I have to say.
But anyway, part of the reason that I didn't do that in the first book is that in America, it's kind of a trope that everyone has to be in charge of their lives, and they have to make, but I'm sorry, the rest of the planet doesn't necessarily live that way. And that is a very, very
live that way.
Yeah, no, we don't. We really don't. And it's a very, very American viewpoint. And I was very aware that I was not writing an American book. I was writing an Irish one. And in Ireland, it's just different. It's a different attitude. And I understand that there were certain readers that were very annoyed by the fact that he just kind of went along with whatever happened, like a little jellyfish. And I'm sorry. That's just, he's not an American. He's Irish. And so that's what, but at the same time, I didn't want him to always and forever be that way. So I wanted to give him some agency, and he really needed to gain some. So in book two, he actually does.
Yeah, it was very nice to see him take at least a little bit. He still is kind of getting swept along to an extent, but within that flow, he's got his steerage, you know. He's like, I've got control of at least something, and I can steer my way through this flow, and I'm not going to let you do it entirely to me.
But in the real world, that's how it works. I mean,
exactly.
For me, speaking of myself, my experience of life, I was a very, very mousy person, very mousy person. And life did shove me around quite a bit. It took a long time to get to where I feel like I'm more in charge of things now. But I'm never 100% in charge of things, and no one is.
Never are, right.
So, and also I think that whole, you know, being in charge of everything and having 100% agency is a fantasy. It's connected to that, the one thing, which that makes me crazy. One person is going to change the entire planet and save absolutely everyone. And I'm like, oh no, it's not just one person. So that's a good reason. Another reason why Liam, he's part of what's going on and why people are pushing and pulling him in different directions. And I can't say absolutely never, but I don't think I'll ever write a story where a character is the one and saves absolutely everyone and does absolutely everything without anybody's help. That's bullshit, in my opinion.
You know,
we all have people in our lives that help us along. I mean, you work hard for whatever it is, you know, but there's always somebody who helps you out. You aren't alone.
I think you should.
I think you're a Warren supporter.
Oh.
I think you should do this instead. You should write a story where the one, the chosen one, is dead.
I'm actually working on a novel right now where the chosen one, there is a chosen one, and things don't turn out as planned. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
I don't know if either of you read the Cracked article about the best fan endings ever written that were better than the actual ending.
No,
and
I didn't.
One of them was what is his name? The geeky kid in the Harry Potter series that should have been the one the whole time, but wasn't the one.
The geeky kid in Harry Potter.
Oh, the one whose parents died?
Yes.
Right?
They're insane.
Neville.
They're not dead. They're,
Neville. That's it, Neville.
I mean, that's like, to me, I always wanted him to be the one. So, you know, it works out that way.
Yeah, me too, actually. I would have loved that. That totally would have set the thing on its ear. It would have been awesome.
Epic.
Right?
Well, actually, okay, so I'm going to skip like 5 questions real quick because, sorry.
And skip down to another one?
I have to, yes. Okay, so because this almost, the idea of the one kind of leads me to this, oddly. Because music is still very prevalent in the book. Not prevalent, but it's lingering in the background. And actually, you have more of the punk scene in this one than you did in the previous one. Like, people who actually associate themselves with it. And I love how Liam is like, wait, what? You know, classic. But to me, you're almost setting the punk scene up. And I don't know anything about the historical realities of Ireland and the Troubles. But you almost are setting them up as like the hope of the Troubles. In that they don't care about the politics. They just want to, you know, listen to music and make music and hang out together.
Newsflash, I did not make that up.
Okay, see there. Thank you. Learn something new every day. I had a feeling. I mean, it was, you did, it was very subtle to me, but it really seemed to be like you were leading in that direction. So I was wondering how much of an influence it did have on the influence.
I absolutely did not make that up. The punk scene in Northern Ireland was very, very different from the punk scene, if you ask me,
right,
from the punk scene in London. The punk scene in London was all about the tension between the classes and how everything was so set in stone and ossified that nobody could move it at all. And here were all these people who were trapped by circumstance and wanted to bust out. And so it was about anarchy and busting out of everything that had been established and right, stabilized just beyond usefulness. And that's what that was about. Well, in Northern Ireland, they had anarchy. They had anarchy out the wazoo. They didn't want any more. They wanted some stability. So the punk scene in Belfast was all about, we don't care what side of the divide you're from, and we don't care anything. Okay. We just want to hang out, have a good time, get messed up, listen to music, and relax. That's all we want. And we're done with all of the paramilitaries. We're done with all of this crap. We just want to be. We want to live and have a life. Which puts them actually having more in common with the hippie scene in the 60s, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So I thought that was absolutely, utterly fascinating, because I've always had a theory that teenagers will, no matter what circumstances they're born under, they will find something to rebel against.
So, they will rebel against utopia.
Well, I mean, fashion sense seems to be the new one. So.
Yeah. Okay. but yeah, so that's something I totally did not in any way, shape, or form make up.
How much influence, though, did that scene, that mentality, have on the eventual actual historical end of the Troubles and the peace agreements that finally came, but it took forever?
Yeah, I don't know. The punk scene, the punk movement in Northern Ireland actually ended in 1981. Mm. In London, it lasted 9 months.
Right.
So in 1976, yes, 9 months. So it struggled against the situation for quite a long time. I'm trying to think of when the Peace People movement came about. I want to say that was in 76 or 77, I want to say, but I'm not one. I'm not 100% on that, because it's been a while since I've read that. But there was a movement consisting of mothers of children and mothers of sons who had all died and had husbands who had all died in this war, and they wanted it to stop. And they needed it to stop. So these women from both sides of the divide got together. And I have no doubt in my mind that to a certain extent, the whole movement in that sense of the punk movement being like, I feel like, based on what I've read. Again, this is from an observer who not necessarily has, I don't necessarily have all of the picture, but I feel like that was definitely an influence in that movement. They won the Nobel Peace Prize that year. And they did make some forward movement, but they didn't succeed. It ultimately failed.
That's depressing.
Yeah, it was kind of depressing to read about, but it was just really interesting that it actually happened at all. But yeah, I feel like maybe it had something, but the peace agreement and all that didn't happen until 1998, I think.
1998. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So
I was in England in mid 90s.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, it's like, I remember thinking, I was like, oh, well, okay, I'm in a city that potentially could have a bombing. And you know, it was still getting closed down a lot, the train systems and everything. Mm-hmm. And so it was something that I followed when I got back home, just because, you know, it's not something at the time that we didn't live with that in the United States.
We still don't live with that.
I know, it's true.
We don't. Not anything like it.
We like to pretend that we do, but we don't.
Oh my God, we're the special snowflakes. That was another aspect of 9/11 that just drove me absolutely nuts.
American exceptionalism.
Oh, jeez. It means more because it happened to us. Oh, wow.
No. It's been happening elsewhere for decades. So
exactly.
Actually, something on the music. One of my favorite scenes in the book is when Father Murray and Liam are in the underground area, and Liam finally gets the records, and they have an argument. Well, not an argument so much as Father Murray is essentially begging him, please don't play it too loud. Liam's like, no, I won't play it too loud.
Yeah. We have definitions of loud, different definitions of loud, and you know, that's just how it's going to be.
I think he was playing the Stones. I think he's playing Rolling Stones, if I recall. Yeah. I just thought that was so funny. It's like, yes, this is the perfect scene of the the old guy telling the young whippersnapper, he's not very young, but yeah, don't play the music too loud. And it's like, oh, well, go to hell.
Yeah, I couldn't resist.
That's good.
Yeah.
But what I'm taking away from this is we're definitely going to get to see more of the punk scene in the third book.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Excellent. Good.
Yeah.
I don't think you could drop it. I mean,
that's the thing. I just, nobody knows about it. Nobody knows about the punk scene there. And so much music came out of it. You too, for one thing.
Well,
Bono.
Yeah.
It's your hook. So you got to keep up with it, right?
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. Yeah. I like the punk stuff. And I like the music stuff. The way you, I'm thinking the previous book, with the sort of grungy, really loud, impossible to hear, like under basement, music, like concerts. They're not really concerts so much as just someone playing really loud music. Yeah, they're not even shows. It's just what you call them. They're just, you know, grungy. There's like nasty tables and beers all over the place, and everyone's just bouncing around, just loud and.
Yeah, the old hole in the wall kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Best clubs ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nostalgia. Not nostalgia for me because I wasn't even born yet.
Yeah, I didn't even make that up either. Because I believe that there was the Pound. It was a nightclub downtown Belfast. It wasn't underground or anything like that. But there was a bar called the Pound.
That name is hilarious.
There was that, and there was another one too, and I can't remember which one it was. But the record store I'm describing in the second book actually existed.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I love the historical. I mean, that's really one of my favorite parts of your books is
thank you.
The amount of historical influence that you're actually embracing and utilizing for the books. Because you will see that in a lot of urban fantasies yet, because they are in spaces that do exist and are recognizable. So obviously you have to kind of go, okay, this place is real, this place is real. But they'll still make up other things like stores and whatnot. You're like, couldn't you have just used an actual store like the Walmart in the corner?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I was very lucky to have Nicholas White,
right?
You know, to confer with on that, because he was like, oh, you know, this part where Liam and Fowler Murray are walking down the street. Well, I was in Belfast at that time, going to school. There was a shop here, and this is what it looked like, and you know, lots of, and I did make up some stuff, but
right.
Because you kind of have to, but it was just really cool having Nicholas to like add little things there. There was a little grocery store on that corner. Yeah. All kinds of cool stuff like that. So, that was fun, but definitely that record store did Good Vibrations did and does exist. And it's run by a gentleman named Terry Hooley, who was, I think they call him like the godfather of Irish punk, because he was one of the, if not the main guy. He actually got a recording studio started up and got the kids involved in getting their own bands and all that. It was his way of getting them away from the paramilitaries and all of the crazy that was happening. And he tried really hard to get a music scene started and rolling and moving under nigh impossible circumstances. Which I think is rather heroic, right. Frankly.
It was an interesting touch that the sort of peaceful punks. And I hadn't really thought about it. And because you're right. I mean, like, the impression of the punk scene is that whole anarchy in the UK. It was nice seeing the punk scene, because, like, the people that I've known as punks over the years and like the bands that I've enjoyed are definitely the most more subversive, politically aware sort of groups.
Oh yeah.
And that's my favorite aspect of punk, but I hadn't really kind of made that connection with, well, if you're living in an environment where, you know, it's not a class warfare that you're worried about, but it's, you know,
well, it is a class warfare.
Well,
but
right,
it's...
it is too. But if you're already living within the chaotic system and it's not, you know, the sort of rigid, like in the UK, I hadn't really thought about how that would interpret into the scene so much as and that you brought out, and I loved how. Oh, I'd love, and I'm not going to ruin it. I'm not going to say anymore because I don't want to ruin anything about them. But I loved it. It was fun.
You can type me a message and let me know what it is. I'm totally curious now.
What I'm talking about? Yeah. Who they are. Who the punks are.
Oh.
Inevitably. I loved it. That was nice. Nice touch. But, okay, so I get to ask the next question because I made most of the questions, I guess.
You didn't make most of the questions. You just
teasing you,
you
honey.
Stole questions from me.
Yes, I stole questions from you. Okay, so the Order of St. Ursula.
Oh, yeah!
So kick-ass!
I love it! Yeah, I had always intended for them to... go their own way and be more influential in the story than they were at the very beginning. I always intended it because they are mentioned.
Mentioned in the first one.
Catherine is in the first book.
In the first book, you meet her and you kind of go, oh, okay, you know, they're intriguing. I think we actually asked you a question about them, like, are there going to be more about them? But the nice thing for me was that with the death of Mary Kate in the last book, you didn't really have a strong female character anymore. And so I was really happy that you reintroduced, you know, like a kick-ass chick. You have a couple of others in this book as well that I'm sure are leading to something more. But
oh, yes.
Saint Ursula was like, you know, like in your face, they kick ass. I think it's kind of hilarious that they're mostly Americans, which
Sister Jenny's actually an American of Irish descent.
Oh, well, there you go. But
yeah,
no, hilarious. But what was originally sort of your inspiration for the Order and the characters?
I'll have to confess. One, I love Brotherhood of the Wolf. And one of my favorite characters in that particular movie is the nun assassin. I love her! Oh my god, she's awesome. Oh, she's awesome. I love her. And so she just kind of stayed in the back of my mind. And so when I started writing this book, I was like, there have to be nun assassins. There have to be. Oh, my God. There must be. So, yeah. And so Sister Catherine was born, who's named after my sister.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And one of my favorite things so far is that there's a certain symbology that goes with them. With the nuns that absolutely no one has mentioned or picked up on yet.
Damn it!
Absolutely no one.
Back and read the scene.
Yeah, it's connected into Irish mythology. I'll just leave it at that.
Aha! So Jen will be. You'll get a angry like Twitter message. I can't figure it out. I've been up for 16 hours.
Oh my god!
It's actually pretty obvious, but if you know anything, but yeah. But nobody's picked up on it. I love it. I love sneaky
people are gonna pick up on it when they read it because you've given them the hint. Damn it.
Well, yeah, now they'll know. But yeah,
let's see.
Well, actually, related to this is not a fun question.
Not a fun question.
Well, I should say it's not a yay kick ass nuns. No, it's not that kind of question. Just one that Jen and I were both curious about, which is the way the church or certain aspects of the church are represented here. In particular with relation to Father Murray, because the inspiration behind why Father Murray kind of changes his view and why he wants there to be, I guess, a truce, you would say, between the Fae, and the church, is some of the kinds of awful things that he's been a part of, and particular the very introductory chapter, that's sort of the beginning of it. We see this very disturbing act we don't see it directly, but we learn that essentially it happens. And this becomes a sort of formative experience for Father Murray. And we were kind of wondering, sort of in writing the church this way, were you at all worried about maybe stepping on toes, or did you sort of see this as, I don't know, so, was this something that you see as developing in a way that's going to go past the kind of, you know, the fallen are evil, we have to destroy them all, and like, you know, that kind of representation of the church? That was my impression of an angry church person.
First of all, I'm glad you asked that question. Because again, that is something I didn't necessarily make up. I actually read about that, including the bathtub. I read about this in an Irish newspaper a year before. I don't remember what year it was. It wasn't very long ago, where they had a construction crew had gone in and the church had sold a piece of property that was once an orphanage. And the construction company had gone in with bulldozers and discovered the secret room with the manacles, the chains, the bathtub, the whole routine.
That's scary.
Yeah, isn't that terrifying? So I did not, in fact, make that shit up. I was actually using some stuff that had actually happened as far as that went.
Creepy.
Creepy, yeah. I think that, yes, it's. I always worry about stepping on people's toes. It's just, that's just who I am. But, because, you know, it's something to worry about. And I love to worry. Anyway, it's my other hobby. But I really feel like the church really messed up in that regard. Because so many people have relied upon them, and they have betrayed people in many ways by not owning up to screwing up. And I just think it's very, very wrong. So if people want to take that as a criticism of the church, then so be it. I think the Catholic Church can do and has done many really, really positive things, but they've also done very many real and evil things. So if they aren't willing to fess up to the really bad and evil things that they have done, I think it does a disservice to even the really good things that they have done. It colors everything. Yeah, but again, it's this, they're human beings like anybody else. I think it's extremely problematic that everything is male-centric. I think that is one of their biggest problems.
Give it another 10,000 years, they'll figure it out.
Right. So, yeah, but on the other hand, I have friends who are priests, and my parents have a lovely... I love the parish priest in my parents' church. He's really fun to talk to. He's really young and just funny. He's really funny to talk to. And there's also a priest who lives in Ireland that I talk to fairly frequently. So yeah, it's I have mixed feelings about the church, if that's not obvious.
I think a lot of people, especially now, have mixed feelings about the church, based on some of the stuff that has been uncovered.
Yeah, and I really, really don't like that the bishops are showing up at government meetings and trying to sway government policy, because frankly, either you, at that point, you have to say that you are now a political organization and you should be paying taxes.
Because, I agree with that.
Yeah, because you are no longer operating as merely a religious organization. That's, you've crossed the line. I have a huge problem with that.
Well, it's interesting too, because obviously, you know, obviously religion plays a big role in people's politics, and that's, to me, that's fine. I mean, they use it as their sort of moral guidepost and helps them make decisions.
Yeah, I'm okay with them using it as their moral...
Right, when the church specifically steps in, the church, not the individuals that are part of the church, but the church itself, and the leadership, whatever, and at this point, let's be honest, that many churches in this country are operating as businesses and not churches in the first place.
Yes.
because they get around that whole nice loophole of we're a church, so we don't have to pay taxes.
Exactly.
So, and that makes it, you know, it's a fine line to me, and I think most of them have crossed it.
Oh, yeah. So, oh, yes. And I agree. And not only the Catholic Church has done this.
No, it's, right. It's many churches.
No. Most.
They aren't the only ones at fault here. No. So, but yeah, yes, I'm very conflicted on that issue. I really am. I don't feel like I think the Catholic Church has abandoned women and to the point of actively working against them in every way possible. I don't feel like Christianity in general has done women any favor.
Right.
I really, really don't. So
you're going to get some hate mail for that.
Yeah, no kidding. But that's how it is. But that, again, I feel like the Christianity has done many good things. Mm. I just feel like it has also done many bad things.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. So, okay. So let's kind of wrap up. So we got a whole bunch of little tiny questions.
Sure.
So let's go plowing through those. So I'm going to steal some from Jen.
That's fine. Go ahead.
So the first one, Jen really wants to know.
I think you've hinted at the answer to this, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but I wanted to make absolutely sure I had it correct. Sure.
Okay. Fae and Fallen, are they separate species?
Yes.
Okay. Quick. Got that done. Okay. Next question, quickie. And I'm going to use it in a quote, because this is Jen's question. Who
and this
the
comes
hell...
with fist stamping.
Okay. Who the hell is Connor? And I'll do the fist stamping now. I want to know now.
You want me to tell you who Connor is?
No.
Or what Connor is? Really?
Yes, but not on air. You can tell me after. No, I don't want to know, but I do want to know.
Well,
I'm happy to tell you, but I'm not going to
tell
you.
Don't tell me. Give me a hint.
Well, no. Let me rephrase.
Is he Fae or?
Shh, no, let me rephrase. I'll just rephrase the question because you're already going to read the next book, right, Jen?
Yes, I'm going to read the next book.
Are you anticipating putting the answer in the next book?
Absolutely.
Okay, we don't need to know then. We don't need to know, and you can wait for the next book.
Damn it!
So, wait. Already got one mystery. You're trying. You got to figure out the myth thing from earlier. You know. Got it.
No. Are they the Brigid?
Shh. Quiet.
Sisters.
Quiet.
Sorry.
Stop getting answers to everything, crazy person. Okay, so next quick question is actually mine, which is about the titles of your books, because I really like the titles. There's Of Blood of Honey, Of Blood and Honey. It's the first one, and then this one, And Blue Skies from Pain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very different, you know, titles, particularly for fantasy novels, because usually fantasy novels, it's like, you know, The Temptation of the Sword, or, you know, like The Winter Bone, you know, or what, I don't know. I'm just making these up off the top of my head. I don't know. But in any case, right, I'm really curious, where did these titles come from?
First of all, the reason why I'm naming them the way they are is because I from the beginning, I really wanted the titles to fit together and make a poem. Not that I'm crap at poetry, frankly, because I'm dyslexic. There's this little connection that between auditory and visual that is, I guess, damaged or not connected or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, I always had a problem, and I still do. I have to read my prose aloud in order to hear the rhythm of it. But I'm kind of tone deaf when it comes to that. So I never really got poetry. I never really understood it. So, but at the same time, I admire it. It's one of those things. So, anyway, I wanted it to fit. Wanted all the titles to fit together as a poem, and
so
that's where that comes
from. Do you have your third title?
No, I don't. I'm making it up as I go along.
Oh, very interesting.
Yes.
I was trying to count the syllables to see if possibly they'd end up being a haiku if you had the third one.
No, it's too long to be a haiku. Sorry.
Oh, darn. That would have been really clever. Wait, no. Of Blood and Honey, that's five. Oh, no, it wouldn't be a haiku.
Nope.
But the next one has to be only five words now. Five syllables, too.
Yeah, I guess it does.
You know,
That's true.
Good luck with that.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I don't think it'll be that hard, really. Something will come to me. It generally does.
That'll be really cool. Okay, so yeah.
I'm stealing the last question because he's still mine. And he's very upset about something.
I'm not upset.
You were upset.
I was just...
When you were reading the book, you were very upset, and I think you cried a little.
I might have.
So the last question is, can your last book please just be a typical fantasy novel with a romance element that ends happy, please? Because he loves your book, but he really needs some happy.
We'll see. I have to say, I am frustrated with Joss Whedon because every single romance that's happy in his always ends horribly and horrible.
Horribly,
bad.
Horribly,
horribly bad. Horribly bad. I loved, you know, Zoe and Wash. I really did, and I was really happy with the fact that they're a happy couple, and then. Yeah, so
I didn't really care so much about the Zoe Wash as I did just care about Wash, and I didn't want him to die.
Well, I knew
if you had killed Zoe, I would have been happy with that.
Yeah, I do have to say, the more I watch Joss Whedon, the more I'm like, hey, I like to flatter myself and think that we think alike. But
Sometimes,
a lot of times I'll like, you know, if I was writing this, I would do that. And then he does that, and I go, mm-hmm, oh, yeah.
Right, so
and that was one of those times.
Our tagline tonight, and I'm going to explain it to Duke, Sean, who obviously did not read your acknowledgments, but you mention Scott, Gentleman Bastard Lynch, for telling you that you're too mean to your characters.
Yeah, I love that.
And That's the reason that the tagline was, you know, giving awards to people who are bastards to their characters. Because you're kind of a bastard to your characters.
I am. I admit it. I am the bitch goddess of Liam's world.
Yes. Oh, yeah. For sure.
Acknowledgements.
Back of the book, where acknowledgements go.
Oh, well, sometimes they go in the front. Don't yell at me.
Yeah, that's true.
Sensitive.
Anyway, that's now you understand the tagline, my dear.
I do have to say I am. I'm proud of that.
So, yes, we would like a little bit of happy. He was very sad when Mary Kate was
That tore me up. Can I just say that was fucked?
It was fucked. It was.
I was like, no, but I was like, it makes sense, but no.
Oh, dude, why? I was in the same place. Seriously, I was. It was like one of those silly scenes from Romancing the Stone, right? Where I was like... I have to type this and I really don't want to.
You get that way with your characters, like, you know, you have to kill a character, but it's like, but I don't want to.
I do. I'm such a huge sap. You can totally, yes, mock me for that. I am a dork.
I do the same thing.
Giant dork.
There's a novel I've been meaning to write, but I can't write it because it's so depressing.
Yeah. No, but I think that the way I plan it is that things will, you know, slowly get better for him.
They better.
Yeah.
That fool deserves it, you know.
Yeah, he's worked really hard. He really has. And mm-hmm.
I do believe in rewarding
people for working really hard. Speaking as the bitch goddess of Liam's world.
Our very, very last end-of-the-line question is, of course, you know, what can folks expect from you within the next year? If you got convention, appearances, new stories, books, whatever, you know, what have you got coming?
Well, I'm going to be at NorwestCon next weekend. Yay! And I plan on being at WorldCon in Chicago. And I'll be at ApolloCon and ArmadilloCon. I'm teaching the ArmadilloCon Writers Workshop again, running it. I think this is my fifth year now.
Where's ArmadilloCon at?
It's in Austin!
Where do you think?
Shut quiet!
And it's called ArmadilloCon. Let's just...
They have armadillos in Florida?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I've seen them dead on the road, but they're there.
Yeah, that's generally how you can tell.
They're stinky bastards, though.
Yeah, they really are. They're nasty. But yeah, that's all the convention appearances. I am working on a new novel that is totally different from The Fae and the Fallen, and it's a YA novel, and I should finish that like last week, but I haven't yet. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Joe. I'm sorry. Yeah, but I need to get that finished pronto and get that turned in and stuff. And there's a short story called Glass Coffin on Revolution SF, and that's it for now.
Well, that sounds like enough.
That sounds like, wow, you're going to be a busy, busy person.
I really am. I really am, and I need to write faster. Write faster. Write faster!
I cannot wait till one day I'm one of those author people that gets to go to conventions and all that kind of fun stuff.
Well, you can go now. But
I can't afford to go now.
Well, I hear you, and you know it's yeah.
I need a couple hundred bucks of an advance for this.
Oh yeah, I hear you. And the only reason that I can afford to go is because I have a husband who has a regular job.
Isn't that nice? Oh, I use mine for that too.
It's fabulous.
Hooray, standard patriarchal structures of
relationships. I know, and I'm a feminist. I should be ashamed.
Nah, it's not.
Ashamed. As long as you clean the house.
No, it's...
And I mow the lawn sometimes, and he does the laundry, and I wash the dishes.
Oh,
and I make him dinner because he's my sweetie pie.
Aww. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a better wife than I.
Yeah, she doesn't. Yeah, if she makes him dinner, it's like, I'm just going to microwave you some fucking fish sticks. Like,
that's bullshit. I've never made fish sticks.
Well, I have a slow cooker. So I can throw things in the slow cooker and forget about it.
I've got chili verde.
Otherwise, things get burned. Because I walk away and I get all involved in the book stuff, and then I come back and I'm like, oh my God, the house is on fire.
Now, listeners, you all know the cooking habits of Steam Elect.
It's the most important knowledge you ever...
And now ask me if I'm consistent on these things. That's a whole other story.
Right.
Oh, never. I don't know.
Sure. So I don't know that I'm so idyllic as a wife.
Okay, so if anybody would like to send us a message for whatever, again, you can send hate mail anonymously through us. Although I may be totally honest, if we actually got hate mail, I'm sure we just post it on our blog and make fun of you. So, but please write it if you so choose. I'm just gonna be totally honest. Thanks, we're not gonna pull it.
Not make fun of you, Stina. Make fun of the people sending us hate mail.
No, thanks for advertising for hate mail for me. Yeah. God.
Yeah. So,
yeah, we like doing that.
If you would like to send us a message, whatever you want to send, you want to tell us what you thought of Stina Light's book, or whatever, easily you can do that four ways. You can go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
Email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Twitter.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
And the website.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
There were some little gaps. You almost
there were.
Got
I know,
past.
I almost didn't make it, so. always tough.
Cool.
Yeah, and if anybody has any questions that weren't answered, they can feel free to, email or whatever.
And send you a happy birthday.
Yes.
Yay! Happy birthday to me.
The best birthday you've ever had, because you got to spend it with us.
Yeah! No, that was a bonus. You mock, but it is a bonus. It's really cool. And I had flowers for my agent and my husband.
See, everybody, so you have been party to the wonderfulness that is Stina's birthday, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, thank you for being on the show, Stina. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yep, you'll be back here again. You got another book at some point. So.
Will it be more than once a year, pretty please?
Yes.
Yay!
Okay. you got to tone it down a little, like, woo, you're getting a little too excited.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, all right, if I have to. How's that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we'll definitely get you on. That'd be great. We could do a discussion episode.
Yay!
Sweet beans on toast. You could be our female Jason Sanford, because Jason Sanford's on this show so much.
He's our go-to guy. Jason, do you have time? No. Well, that's good, because you're on the show. Wait, what? It's Jason, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, cool. Everybody have a good week, and we will see you next week with something else. I don't know what it is, though.
I don't know either. It's on the schedule. Whatever. It's an interview.
Yay!
I think.
Yay!
Yeah, Sherwood Smith. Sherwood Smith's
oh,
on the
yay! Oh, shoot. I gotta read
We have a 700-page novel to read.
Yay!
Yeah.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye!
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Heart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.